I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Alex McLaren. I'm an actor and I've worked as a communications coach since 2002. Now so much business is being conducted remotely, the ways in which we talk, present, build relationships and connect is changing. In this podcast, I want to explore all those issues and prove to you that no matter who you are, you can talk to anyone. Hello and welcome to You Can Talk to Anyone, the podcast where we open the bonnet on our communications engine. I'm Alex McLaren.
And I'm Tom Zielinski.
And today we welcome a special guest, Ned Sedgwick. Hello, Ned.
Hello. How are you both today?
Very well. Thank you very much for joining us. This is the second of a number of visits that we want to make to the topic of confidence. And Ned, I've known you since you were a very young confident person.
Yes, and you were also a very young confident person.
But there is a, what, 15 years between us? I'm 47.
I'm not counting, Alex.
I guess the reason I'm raising it is that today we are peers working together, but once upon a time you were a child being babysat by me, I think, when I was briefly sleeping in a hallway in Tom and Deborah's flat, which was in the basement of your house.
Yeah, it all kind of sounds quite Victorian.
But I guess the reason I'm interested in it is that children have a very different approach, it seems me, to this question than the adults that Tom and I have to deal with when we're going in and coaching them in businesses.
Yes. In
that there's a sort of, there's just an innate unself-consciousness about them. And although we can talk about shy kids and outgoing kids, we don't talk about confidence in the same way.
No. One of the first things we talk about is the fact that children aren't specialists. Mm. They haven't decided what they're good at and what they're bad at. And so they're pretty much willing to have a go at anything. Mm. And then we put them through a process which is seemingly designed to remove that freedom and that confidence, and will tell them very clearly that they're good at some things, are bad at other things, and make them gun-shy. It's called school.
Yes. Your experience, Ned, as somebody who's part of a slightly different generation.
Yes.
And I don't want to over-labor this generation talk, but it's a really interesting topic. And I sometimes think when I'm talking to people your age, that there are things, not necessarily that I'm missing, but I've maybe forgotten.
Well, there are a few interesting things. I would say, working with people now who are sort of slightly more mature vintage and people who are younger than me,
For avoidance of doubt, tell the listeners how old you are.
I am 30 years old.
Fine.
I am a millennial. Mm-hmm. And about 4 years ago, I was commissioned to make a podcast about being a millennial. Over the years that podcast was being made, millennials went from being kind of the youngest people with a voice to no longer the youngest people with a voice. We were replaced by Gen Z. And something I find quite interesting is, I would say the experience between my generation and your generation may not be as different as my generation and our colleague Gina's daughter, who is actually, now I think about it, 20 years younger than me, so that's quite a big difference. But between Gen Zs and millennials, I think that because of the internet and because of just the social media, because of the prevalence of smartphones, at such a young age, it has changed the game a bit, and it has changed conversations around confidence. It's changed self-image. It's changed how you portray yourself. You know, I got Facebook when I was 15, and back then what you would do is you would upload a photo album of 100 photos, of which 5 of them were good. And the aim of the photo album was to make it look like you were cool and having fun. Mm. So there are bad photos of you smoking, bad photos of you drunk, and maybe two or three good photos of you. Mm. 10 years later, you were growing up with Instagram, where you would curate the one or two images of yourself that are the best representation of who you are, how you're looking, what you're doing, or that moment in your life. And you are so much more on show as a result of that. And I would say that that kind of general freewheeling Gen X millennial kind of let's go out, let's get, you know, the lager out culture, which we were all kind of part of or adjacent to, is more similar than the experience of a generation below me. That said, my experience of school was probably quite different to a lot of people for reasons which I've only just become apparent. I always struggled quite a lot at school, despite being incredibly confident. Mm. Every school report would say how confident I was and how willing I was to talk. And
confident is one of those code words that teachers sometimes use, isn't it? It generally means pain in the ass.
Exactly. But I was recently diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder. I was diagnosed when I was 30, and a lot of pieces of my life fell into place.
Gosh.
Particularly around my confidence. And essentially, my use of outward confidence as a mask for the things that I was deeply unconfident about, and the things which essentially I would refuse do or ignore or cover because being told you are not good and being told that you aren't working hard enough when you're trying your hardest and still failing essentially eviscerates a lot of confidence. But to make up for that, I would be the noisiest person in the room and I would wear my intelligence and my knowledge on my sleeve. And again, I think that this is something I was maybe at the last edge, the last crest of a wave where I was accused of being disruptive and stuff. And there would be no further psychological questions asked of me. There would be no attempt at treating that in a way that would help me.
So this is it's interesting. I didn't know about that, Ned.
It's very recent. I mean, Tom.
Wow.
Tom, who has to help edit podcasts I edit and clear up messes that I make, both literally and figuratively, is probably well aware that at times my attention to detail is low.
We're working on it.
Yeah.
So but this is interesting because you're talking here about the confidence you presented and the internal feelings and the gap between them. And this is something that I was thinking about. We spoke about this last time Tom and I met. We were thinking about the difference between the sort of the feeling of confidence and the behavior of it.
Yes.
And I started, since then, I've been sort of chewing over my sort of questions about what is that feeling of confidence? And I wonder if we're being, or rather, whether we're talking about the same thing when we discuss it with different people. Mm. Because, I mean, particularly when you're talking to men, I sometimes wonder whether we are as specific about emotions as we really need to be in order to be useful. I think when people are coming to me with kind of confidence challenges, I always want to be as specific as possible. So I say, okay, tell me about the situation. And once we get down to it, then we can work from the very particular kind of levers and situations and personalities, and we can work our way through that. And so we never maybe really need to attend to, actually, is this a confidence problem or is it something else? Mm. And I'm just wondering, what is the feeling of confidence that was, I mean, I suppose that if you're at school and you're feeling that you're not making the grade or meeting people's expectations, a feeling is probably one of shame or guilt.
There are things which I'm beginning to unpack about myself. So essentially, attention, ADHD is a deficit of, and I always get it confused between serotonin and attention to detail, serotonin or one of those ones that makes you feel happy. But it also means that you can be quite easily stimulated. So essentially, I'm always looking for minor buzzes. And one of the ways I get buzzed is talking. Mm-hmm. But when I'm feeling awkward, when there is a silence, I do just as much talking, if not a little bit more, than when I'm feeling supremely confident in a situation. Mm. And I would say that some people would see me when I'm feeling incredibly stressed in a high-pressure situation, and I cannot allow silence. I cannot allow 2 seconds, because as soon as that happens, my brain starts panicking, and it's saying, get that serotonin in, get that in, stay distracted, stay busy. That you get, it's something almost ineffable. It's something almost uncatchable.
There's a difference in the happy, confident energy of you and your friends riffing off each other, and the energy of, well, the word you used was panic, and that's interesting. I kind of wonder whether the sort of the adrenaline of that situation is almost it's almost separate to the kind of the emotional circuit, because it's your body reacting to threats, and certainly there's an emotional dimension to it, but it's not part of the emotional suite that we talk about when we're saying, hey, let's talk about our feelings.
If you're happy to answer this question, Ned, what are the situations that make you feel least confident and least comfortable? Because, you know, you work with us, and our background is theatre and improvisation, things which make a lot of people feel profoundly uncomfortable and uncertain. But I remember, again, at the risk of coming off like a sort of seedy uncle, seeing you doing comedy sketches in front of audiences of parents and teachers when you were about 10 years old.
I get nervous before I go on stage. I've done live podcast recordings, and I do get nervous. I think everyone does, and it comes out in funny ways, but it's not a big deal. I've done lots of speeches at weddings. I'm getting married next month, and I'll be doing a speech at my wedding. I'm really excited about it. Every time I do it, I have the confidence, in inverted commas, that I know I've done it before, so I trust myself. Also, I know that at school I was told this is something you can do. Yep. You can talk. You can distract people. You know, there is truth in that. And distracting people in a lesson isn't great, but distracting people on stage or distracting people at a wedding or kind of making yourself a centre of attention can be a terrible thing, but it can be a good thing. I suppose the things that fill me with absolute dread is when I meet people who don't give anything back. And that is a very selfish way of putting it. When I meet people who are kind of, don't find me funny, or don't. And I don't think I'm that funny. I think that I have the confidence to say the things that come into my head. I would say a lot of other people would have similar thoughts and not necessarily be willing to say or take the risk to say it. I find that incredible. And I'll go down a spiral. If I'm not getting anything back, I'll make worse jokes. I'll double down on jokes which haven't landed just to be like, this is what I'm trying to do. So I think being around certain characters makes feel, or when I know I've done something wrong, or I've done something that might upset somebody else, and I have to make that first step to saying, I need help with this. That fills me with absolute dread, such dread that quite often I will never, ever get round to do it. I was not taught to improve myself at school. I was taught that I was lazy at school. I was not taught how the coping mechanisms in order to overcome that deep-seated dread. And instead of that, what I will do is I will do something I'm more interested in, and I will avoid at all costs that conversation where I go, I don't know how to do this. Please, can you explain to me, with no jokes, no distractions, please sit down and explain to me how I can do this. And I'm really sorry, I will also probably forget what you've explained, so I might need to ask again in 2 weeks' time how to do this, and that will make it much harder.
That thing you're saying about people who don't give you anything back, that is actually something that people say to me when I'm working with people in business. And they're often describing there's a particular situation, it might be a particular boss or a particular client that saps me of confidence. And it's because, in fact, I think that withholding something, sort of holding back on reaction and not really joining in, that means that that there isn't a relationship. And I think that if there is no relationship, someone in most people can tend to feel a bit lost, and particularly if they're kind of socially sticky people like you. And it's interesting that in order to vary your approach, you may have to do things which feel very unlike you.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is really curious. One of the things you mentioned, the outward bravado that I think sometimes people will develop. And this is one reason why I think confidence, some people look at it slightly skeptically, because when they see it, they mistrust it, because they've come across, or everybody's been in that situation where we've, as you say, doubled down, or we've gone big, because we're masking actually the opposite of what we're trying to display.
Yes, because it's possible we can think of people in the public eye who are full of swaggering confidence, which appears to be backed up by absolutely nothing at all.
This is it. This feels like there's a confidence on the one side and competence on another, and that these two qualities are actually in opposition to each other.
And this is something that I've been trying to get my head around when it comes to talking to people. It's about what you can convince other people you can do, and then it's about doing it rather than what you feel in your heart of hearts you can do. Because quite often you undersell yourself. You're like, I couldn't pick up a phone and call this person to be a guest on my podcast. I couldn't do that. Why not? It's picking up a phone. Actually, because I've done a few wedding speeches, friends have started coming to me for advice. And one of the main things I always say, and it's something I always have in my head before I do anything, is that I'm not being asked to use a different muscle or I'm not being asked to do a handstand in front of 500 people, which I wouldn't know how to do. I'm not being asked to do a roly-poly. I don't have the muscles to do that. Or I probably could, but I don't know. You're just being asked to use your voice and talk to people. And that's it. There's nothing alien or scary about that.
Actually, what you're saying there about kind of the promises that you make, and it's almost like there's a contract. You've said by behaving in a sort of confident way, you're basically saying I'm you can trust me. And this is really, I think can be fundamentally challenging, because I think this is where some of the imposter syndrome, again, a phrase which comes up every time Tom and I go to work in businesses, the idea that if people knew how I felt about inside, they would not employ me to give them credible advice, for example. This is from a lawyer or a consultant that you might be working with. And so that the develops this gap between this interior feeling and the way I am then behaving. And that can be alarming to people, because they feel so inauthentic. And yes, authenticity is this tremendously important thing which has comes around again and again and again, and becomes more and more important, as Tom mentioned earlier, in sort of in politics. We're looking for people who we feel like, you're not just saying it, I believe in you as well, to the extent that I'll give you my vote.
I'm genuinely not sure. Maybe I would, and maybe this is imposter syndrome, but I'm genuinely not sure I would be that good in an industry I didn't believe in, or doing something I didn't care about, because I am slightly evangelical about podcasts. I do think that they represent a fantastic way. So automatically you go in there jokey or saying something authentic, or I better cover it up and be fun. Mm. They do represent a fantastic way to connect with people. Whether you're doing a podcast...
Amazing synergies with these podcasts.
Yeah, amazing. But you can do a podcast about something you're interested in. It can go out to 5 people, and you can interview loads of other interesting people who are interested in that thing. And that in and of itself is great. And being able to kind of proselytize about that does give me a confidence.
Yeah, I mean, you've kept the promise you were making enough times to know that it wasn't a one-off. And no. So there's a concrete sort of foundation of experience there, which means that it feels like less of a gamble on yourself.
Yeah.
Which is important.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You spoke before about Grown Up Land, which was the podcast that we produced and you were one of the hosts of. Do you remember recording your first episode of Grown Up Land?
I do remember it. I remember how panicky I was, but only realising that I had been afterwards. And it was this thing that I was jumping in to make my point a lot. And I think it came out fine, that first episode. Well, it didn't come out fine because the recording studio we were using was crap. But
so I don't think I remember this. So you scrapped the first episode, did you?
Yeah,
the recording wasn't good enough quality. So you had a pilot. You had a free go.
We had an accidental pilot. It was Alison Spittle, May and Bisha, and we didn't really know each other. And I said stuff about getting in fights when I was 18, about I really opened up in a way that I think is one of the reasons why I worked as a host on a podcast, because you'll go, hey, Ned, what do you think of carrots? Oh, and then tell an incredibly personal story about how I accidentally sat on a carrot or something, the most embarrassing thing that other people wouldn't. And then only realise 2 hours after, oh my God, that's going out to the public.
So how far into the Grown Up Land process was it before you started to feel, oh yeah, it's that thing I'm good at, as opposed to it's this thing that feels untried and untested?
It's a tough one. It's simultaneously after that episode and never. after that episode, I knew I could go on and leave with friends. And this is, I suppose, a big thing for me, is that so long as I could leave a lesson with people liking me, that's all I can do. I might not be able to get the homework done, but if I can leave with making everyone have a laugh, that's fine. So I think that experience, I definitely got better and better and better, and I worked on it. And something I did discover as well is the more if there was a crunch point of research where if I spent 2-3 days doing research for a topic, I would just shout over everyone because I'm so excited about the research I've done. But then if I did too little, I'd shout over everyone to try and cover up the fact I'd not done any research. And it's just stuff like that which I got more confident on. But in terms of whether I could do it or not, it was pretty immediate that I felt, okay, listen back, learn a bit, and just work on that. In terms of improv, when did you start doing improv, Tom?
I started doing improv when I was about 23, 24.
So had you ever been on stage before then?
Yeah. I'd done plays at school and then done comedy shows and plays at university. And I'd always found that very easy and fun. And my first couple of public improv shows were weak.
Mm.
But it didn't put me off. And yeah. I think it was when we started doing our own shows in our own venue, and where I was sort of, alongside Deborah, leading the company, that I started to feel completely secure and confident.
Interesting. So the change of scenery, the change of status didn't make you go, oh my God, now the buck stops with me.
But that gave me confidence. I think you're right. There's a way of framing that as now it's all on my shoulders, which would have been confidence sapping, but that wasn't my experience. What about you, Alan? I remember you taking to public improvisation incredibly swiftly and easily, but I'm not inside your head.
No, well, I mean, I'd done bits of it at sixth form, and obviously I'd done loads and loads of acting. I pitched myself as a performer I left Preston and went to the theatres in Manchester, for example. I was in the National Youth Theatre. I was always trying to test. I suppose I was kind of hunting for imprimaturs from high-status institutions. but I remember when I really thought I wanted to take it seriously was because I was conscious of, as you described, Ned, this gap between how I feel, because I was being validated, but also knowing that I wasn't really engaging with the fear, I think, of failure. And so I remember the first time I saw the Spontaneity Shop perform, and I had an experience watching it, which I have very, very rarely, actually, when I go to the theatre. Which is, I'm identifying so intensely with what is happening on stage. I felt my heart pounding in my chest. And so there was so much adrenaline flooding my system, just watching it, knowing the risks that were being taken on stage. And that, I think, for me, is why this is an interesting subject, because is that the feeling? So this is, for example, most recently I got up and I did a poem at an open mic night in Kent, where I live. I haven't learned anything by heart for a very long time, and I could screw this up. I could lose it, lose my place. It was quite long. And I could feel my heart pounding in my chest. Now, is that a feeling of confidence? I don't think it is. But it's a sensation that maybe I went into improv thinking if I do this, it will go away and I'll become a confident improviser. And I strongly believe it doesn't really happen like that, particularly with improv, but even with sort of acting with a script, you know, when you've got so many people looking at you. I mean, I've done best man speeches. Well, I've done it once, actually, not as many times as you. But when you stand up, do you feel... Can you feel everything pounding, or is it a different internal feeling? Is it just like, oh, good, it's happy days?
First time I did it, it was... there's a video, and I was so nervous when I started. Yeah, I could see how nervous I was. Yeah. I couldn't sleep the night before, and I was incredibly... I was incredibly proud and honoured to be doing it, really. And then... And then somebody had told me, actually, an incredibly... drunk boy next to me had told me, wait for them to laugh, wait for them to finish their laughter, because as soon as you start waiting for them to finish your laughter, you're in control of their laughter. And the first few times I'm talking over it, then you can see the cogs turning in my head. Remember what this drunk boy said to me, and I wait, and suddenly I'm like, oh, let it enjoy every second of it.
Well, there's room for them. This is my big theme at the moment, Tom, which is if it isn't a relationship, then you're not really comfortable. And as soon as you leave room for them to be in the conversation with you,
once you've done it once, it becomes so much easier. And actually, back to the podcasting, I think this is why podcasting's so good, because once you've done it once and had to interview somebody, you have that skill in your locker. And you have the confidence to give someone a call, sit them down, and talk about something you're mutually interested in, or maybe not even mutually interested in. But one kind of final thought on my experience, and something which I do think has impacted my generation, is that we were told when we were leaving university, or starting university, well, you're all screwed because of the 2008 financial crash that just happened. And then Brexit happened, which, of course, some people in my generation voted for, but the vast majority didn't. And our experience has slightly been being screwed over again and again, and we're lucky for what we get. And I think that actually is still quite a powerful one, and I really notice a difference between people in the generation above and below. Gen Z have this, we're going to save this world attitude, or we're going to watch a world burn attitude, but we're going to be here. And the generation above have, weren't the 90s so lovely? Wasn't it good before Blair turned into a war criminal, allegedly? Whereas my generation is, our experience was, Western culture is hypocritical and murderous. Also, we don't have any money anymore. Also, we're going to screw everything over for you. And I do notice amongst my friends there is a different kind of confidence, or gallows confidence of, oh, well, we may as well give it a try. It doesn't really matter anyway.
The confidence of somebody with a noose around their Oh, God, the analysis does sound familiar, even if the experience is different. Thank you so much for joining us, Ned. In terms of talking to anyone, how can people get in touch with you if they want to talk to people in podcast form?
Well, they can email me at ned@the-spontaneity-shop.com, or they can tweet me at Ned Sedgwick. They can send me a Facebook. That would be very nice.
That's generation totally wrong. Totally wrong. Thank you so much for joining us. Tom and I deliver training days to people in business, in person or via Zoom, on all of these topics: client meetings, better negotiations, presenting with confidence, storytelling, networking, and more. And if you want to discuss your company and its needs, get in touch with us, Alex at the-spontaneity-shop.com or Tom at the-spontaneity-shop.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and tune in for more in future. I'm Alex.
And I'm Tom.
And I'm Ned.
Thanks a lot, and goodbye.
You have been listening to You Can Talk to Anyone with Alex McLaren, Tom Selinsky, and our special guest, Ned Sedgwick. The producer for The Spontaneity Shop was Tom Selinsky. You Can Talk to Anyone is brought to you by The House of the Guilty Feminist and is distributed exclusively by Acast.